Welcome to Juno Afternoon on kind of a moody and misty Friday. I'm Rhonda McBride, your host for this hour. Coming up, something you might want to have the last word on, a conversation about end-of-life care. The 2021 school year is in the rearview mirror, a bumpy road for sure. What's ahead? Louisiana and Alaska, two states that may have more in common than you think. And this week's birds to watch and find out about. Now the forecast. Cloudy skies, scattered rain showers, lows in the upper 40s, light winds. Tonight, more scattered rain. In fact, that's pretty much what we're going to see through the weekend. Juno Afternoon will be right back after National Native News. You're listening to Juno Afternoon. Thank you for being here with us on this Friday. I'm Rhonda McBride. Death is just never an easy subject to talk about, but all too often when you're in the midst of dealing with a loss, it is too late to have that conversation with your loved ones. And our guests today hope to make planning for death as natural as life and death itself, and they are here to tell us about a virtual workshop, but we will get to that in a moment. First, let's meet Shauna O'Sullivan and Liz Smith. Shauna is Executive Director for the Foundation for End-of-Life Care, and Liz Smith is an attorney. So Shauna and Liz, maybe we could start off by talking about how it is that you came to want to work in this area, because, you know, most people sort of think of it maybe as morbid. So Shauna, we'll begin with you.
Thanks, Rhonda. I actually began with the Foundation for End of Life after losing my husband. And, you know, he was young and it was a situation that was completely unexpected. So we didn't really prepare for that. And it was very overwhelming going through a lot of the things that people go through all the time at end of life that I just didn't know about until then.
How about you, Liz?
Rhonda, as an attorney, I had wanted to set out on my own, and I had been working as a health coach on the side of my legal job. And I really enjoy drawing people to reach goals. At that point, it was in health, and do something that they struggled to do. And I find that same draw through estate planning of it's such an easy topic when we think about planning for a difficult topic. What would happen if you couldn't make decisions for yourself? What would happen if you pass away to your family and to you? It's both hard to discuss, but then also such an easy thing to put off. And so I'm drawn in my way to how can I make it easier for others to both learn what would happen and then also figure out what their next step would be if they want to take action, and then help them move through that process as painlessly and easily as possible, and then to experience the benefits I see when people do put that plan in place.
Well, death, whether it happens suddenly or, you know, is preceded by a long illness and somewhat expected, is never easy, because once a person is gone, you really can't talk to them about what you think, what they think might be the next move. And I just have to say that, Shauna, you sent me this wonderful booklet that your organization offers to people. It's a guide for helping those you love when you're not there. And it even has separate pamphlets in it for personal records. You can give that information. You know, and I think about all these things today, especially, it's so complicated. I was thinking about myself, if I were gone tomorrow, how would my husband access my Facebook account to shut it down? You know, so many questions. How would he get into my emails just to be able to deal with unresolved issues? I mean, I think today death is much more complicated. Do you agree?
You know, in some ways, I guess it is true. And that's what's great about this guide. It was actually created by two local Juno residents, and one was Virginia Palmer. She was actually one of our our most recent person of the year for all the contributions she's made, both to our board, to the foundation, and to the community. She lost her husband, and he planned well, and she noted that that wasn't always the case. So she developed the first edition of this book, and Hal Geiger helped with the second edition. And it is, it's kind of a little cheat sheet. It has the information that we've all gathered, all these personal details that we need these days just to even get into our phone. You can put that in a little short sheet, but it also gives a guide to what to expect medically, how you deal with hospice care, and is really helpful that way. To answer your question, in some ways it's more complicated, I guess, but in reality, it's been around, you know, the end of life is something that I think we're always surprised. I'm always surprised I never knew more about it before I got to that point. And mostly because when you're at the end, it's really nice to be able to focus on your loved one and not all of the questions around medical issues or their wishes. So advanced directives are also a big part of it. Not only when you're gone, but COVID has taught us, what do you want if you are sick and you can't talk to your loved ones? That's multi-generational. And those are simple things that can start with a conversation. You can read about things in the book and share your ideas and thoughts about what you might want. So we're trying to make it easy.
You know, emails and Facebook accounts are relatively minor in the scheme of things. There are just so many huge issues that loved ones get left to sort out. And one of the things I've hated to see in some families is dissent arise over how to deal with something because their loved one left no clear direction about how they wanted certain things to be handled.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'll let Liz answer that.
Well, just tying in with both is it more complicated? There may be more steps, but I think the biggest challenge has been and is learning what needs to happen or what the tools are that are available to plan, to pass on your passwords, to pass on these stuff, to make it as easy as possible for family if that's an objective of yours. And the foundation's book, the guide that you were talking about, is so valuable and is one resource.
You know, the other thing about hospice is there's a lot of things that they know about the dying process that, because we don't often have extended families today where we've watched a grandparent maybe die at home, there's a lot of things maybe that we don't know. So when a parent dies, things take us by surprise, and it's really good to have that kind of guidance to get through those tough times. So, you know, that kind of education just can't go far enough, can it?
No, and that's really what the foundation was established through. It's the mission is really to support end-of-life services, particularly hospice, but also bereavement care and community education, just so people can hear about it and know what to expect.
So tell us about your workshop and how people can take advantage of that if they're interested.
Well, this is something that we've offered in the past. This is going to be a virtual event on Friday, June 18th at 7 p.m., a little later in the evening, but it's really designed for people to explore this concept, to think about what they want, and then we have Vance Sanders and Liz Smith, who's here with us today, to really answer questions that anyone might have about their wishes and about next steps. Okay, you might know what you want to do, but then how do you set that in place? So she and Vance will be sharing information about advanced directives and about wills, and then also some helpful tools on what the next steps are to set that up for yourself.
So this workshop is Friday, June 18th at 7 p.m. And how do you get in queue to be a part of this?
We have some advertising out. You can go to our website. It's foundationforendoflifecareak.org. And you can register online. And that's really the best way to do it. We have some ads on our page and a little QR reader that they can use to register. And we'll be sharing out the Zoom link on that website.
All right. And finally, before we go, like we talked about earlier, a lot of people feel like talking about death is morbid. And Liz, I'm wondering, how do you go about taking the conversation to a different space?
I focus on the positive aspects. Some of that includes thinking about, I see it over and over with clients where they've been planning, thinking about doing something for years or decades, and then to have that done and behind them when they leave, it's just palpable, the feeling of relief. And then thinking of it as a gift to family. So when you're gone, you don't know what's going to happen, but providing that benefit for your children or whomever will be handling things when you're sick or when you're gone. And also, I see people get more financially organized through the process. And it's funny, a lot of times people will be motivated into planning when someone passes away and they see how easy it is or how horrible it can be. So either ends can move people into action. And but those are some of the positive benefits that I try and focus on.
All right. Well, I want to thank both of you for joining us, and we'll have to have you back maybe to talk more deeply about some of these subjects. So I want to thank both of you and hope your workshop goes well, because I think that certainly it's something that people postpone, and it's not really one of those things you want to do.
Thanks. Thanks so much. I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
All righty. Thanks for joining us.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
This is Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. Our next guest wears a lot of hats in the school district here in Juno. Kristen Garreau is principal of the Montessori Borealis School with students from K through 8th grade, also principal of the Alternative High School, and oversees the Homebridge homeschooling program. Well, Kristen, we want to thank you for being here with us today to share all those different perspectives. But, I just wonder, how in the world do you juggle all those responsibilities?
Just do what I can.
Well, I mean, you are certainly seeing things from different perspectives, different age groups, kids with different challenges. And maybe let's start off with the alternative school, because I think a lot of people worried during this year of COVID that there would be a lot of emotional problems, a lot of challenges in working with kids because they would be hurt, especially by that lack of one-on-one contact.
Yeah, for sure. I had that same concern going into the school year and looking at starting last spring when we suddenly were doing all virtual learning for all of our students. I definitely shared that same concern and was pleasantly surprised this year with not only kind of the resilience of our students, but also the work, how they responded to all the really hard work of our staff in reaching out and making extra connections with students to help them feel that connection, even if they weren't able to be physically present together.
You know, with school kind of being a hybrid scenario at times between home and in person, Do you think that maybe parents developed an appreciation for teachers? I mean, we should always appreciate our teachers, but do you think after this year that there's a difference in the relationship?
I do. I think definitely, and I saw this maybe a little bit more with my elementary students and families because kids needed more help from their parents to do school. And so parents got to see a little bit more of what happens, how school happens, and had that hands-on opportunity. I think it was also really powerful for us at the school side to see families. And we got to see that all, you know, pre-K through the high school students that we work with and get to see what life is like for them at home through the Zoom screen. And, you know, we got to see their pets with them and we got to see who all is around and who's helping them. I think it was really a really great experience. Both, I think parents maybe got some more appreciation for school and teachers, but also I think teachers got to see families and get some more appreciation and understanding of their families that they're working with. It was great.
You know, I think of these sci-fi movies and you see kids, you know, 1,000 years into the future, right, on spaceships, getting classes from Earth or somewhere. And it all just seems so wonderfully high tech and so smooth. But is the virtual world kind of an illusion that there's true intimacy? And intimacy, you know, that's needed for education.
Right. I think really in that situation, it depends on the combination of people that you have, because I think that there were opportunities to create that this year, even through the virtual, in that virtual way, where connections, honest, really genuine connections were made and nurtured and sustained in the virtual realm. I do think that happened. I think for some students, though, it was harder to have that connection with their teachers or with, you know, their trusted adults at school through the virtual lens. But I definitely think it did happen for some students. So it's an interesting mix of those things. Because I think.
So what about your at-risk students at the alternative school? Did you do anything extra to kind of be sure they would be okay during this?
Yeah, so we took the opportunity to kind of rethink what our schedule looked like in general. And instead of having all of our classes every day and having a really busy Zoom schedule, we thought it would be maybe better to have fewer classes focusing on at one time. So we had longer classes, but fewer classes going on at one time. And so I think that really helped our students. So they weren't going from one Zoom to the next, to the next, to the next, and kind of getting lost in the Zooms. I think that helped us. And then also we took the chance to do more advisory meetings with our students. And those were oftentimes just fun things to do together. Whole school Zoom games that happened, and opportunities to have fun connections with each other. So we did that more often, which was a lot of work for our staff because it takes a lot of energy to do that kind of thing. But I think it really paid off for our students.
So it really stretched your creativity as educators.
I think it did. Yeah, I think we saw that district-wide. People had to get really creative in maintaining those connections, for sure.
So with your Homebridge program, how many people do you typically have in the Homebridge program in a year, and what happened after COVID?
Yeah, it was definitely an interesting transition. Typically, in a typical year, we usually have about 35 students in Homebridge. And this last fall, after the spring, kind of everything going online and then people wondering what's going to happen and uncertainty with the start of the school year, we blossomed into 435 students.
My goodness.
Yes, it was quite an explosion of our program, and a very exciting and fast-paced fall trying to catch up and really do all that we needed to do to support families who were making that choice.
So why do you think so many jumped to that? Was it fear of spreading COVID, or was it just they wanted more consistency?
I think a lot of people wanted that consistency and to be able to have some control over what their daily schedule would be. It was a combination, I think, too, of we didn't know exactly what things were going to look like in the classroom or how long we would be virtual district-wide. And so with not knowing what things were going to look like, I think a lot of people chose Homebridge because they knew that, okay, we can just make this choice now and we can know what our school year will look like for our family. So I think that was it was great for people to be able to make that choice.
I know that suddenly going from supporting about 30 or 40 people to, 10 times that number could be a huge challenge. Did parents get a little frustrated perhaps in having this new role?
Well, hopefully not too many people got frustrated. We were able to act quickly to bring more people on board to help process all the new folks. It did take us a little bit at the beginning to kind of get caught up. But then I think once we had everybody and all their paperwork on, and then we were able to really continue to support them.
Yeah. So what's ahead for next year for the children? Are you planning on an in-person school over at the alternative school and also at the Montessori school?
Yeah, I think district-wide, we're planning on kind of things getting back to that traditional 5 days a week, full school days, district-wide.
So how about the homeschooling? Will you see as many people, you think, as you did this past year?
I think we'll see some reduction in our homeschool numbers, but I think we'll still have a few that we're anticipating about 150 students maintaining enrollment with Homebridge and, people who did it and liked it and want to continue doing that and found that it was really rewarding for their family. And so we're happy to keep supporting them through that.
So we didn't talk at all about the Montessori school, which has kids, from kindergarten through eighth grade?
We actually have pre-K ages 3 all the way up through 8th grade. So,
that's quite a range. So, and I'm sure different at every grade level, but in general, what did you see there?
Well, one thing that was really exciting at Montessori was we were able to have in-person school all year long with our pre-K and kindergarten students. So we had a group of about 15 who were in school all year long, which was really exciting. And then we had the virtual and then the hybrid and then more in person for the rest, just like the rest of the neighborhood schools.
I know the kids sounded like they were really glad to go back to school. Usually you hear them kind of grumble, after
they
coming
were very,
back.
Yeah, they were very excited to come back to school. We definitely saw that, we had most of our students were back full time or 4 days a week, full days starting in April. And it was just, kids were super jazzed to be at school, and we really saw that.
So tell me this, what you have a big panorama there in front of you of all those different groups of children. What is your big takeaway from the 2021 school year?
I think that's a good question, and I don't know if I've totally synthesized for myself yet what that big major takeaway is. But I think some of the things I've seen are, students are resilient, kids are resilient, and they were really out of school, out of the school building for a year, from March to March. But they were ready to come back and keep going. Also, learning didn't stop while they were at home. When they were doing all the virtual work, the learning might have been a little bit different, but I think that kids learned a lot about themselves, about their families, about their things that they really enjoyed doing. And I don't want to discount those things and those learning experiences being just as important, than as to what we do at school. And so I think when we spend a lot of time talking about the learning loss that might have happened in some academic areas, I don't want to forget the learning experiences that kind of balanced, encountered some of that. That was different kind of learning that I think is really important.
Well, hopefully the children will have good memories of adults really trying to help them get through the school year and all the workarounds to try to keep things as normal as possible. Maybe that will stay with kids for years to come. Do you think?
Yeah, who knows? It'll be really interesting to learn from kids as they get older what it is that they remember from this year and what is sticking with them and what impacts will, you know, be lasting for them, both positive and negative. You know, we're going to see a little bit of both.
So. Yeah, this will probably be in sort of the consciousness of children until the last preschool child graduates. Something
definitely
they won't forget. Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Kristen. It was nice to kind of get that panorama from all of your experiences. Thanks.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. You're listening to the celebration in downtown Juno on Wednesday night, right out in front of Deccan Dave's. It capped off an agreement between the state of Alaska and the state of Louisiana to work together to promote seafood and tourism. A delegation from Louisiana, which included the lieutenant governor, spent a few days in Juno. They visited seafood processing facilities, restaurants, and fishing boats. In that group, Samantha Carroll, the head of the Louisiana Seafood Promotions and Marketing Board, and Chef Mike Brewer. I sat down with both of them on Wednesday night to talk about their trip and the importance of the fishing industry to both states.
Fishermen are fishermen, wherever they may be. You go out on the water and you make your living there. And as a chef in New Orleans, I like to respect the fishermen that catch that daily bounty that they bring to us. And here in Juneau, and I'm sure across Alaska, it's the same. You know, we worked yesterday with a chef here, Nell Udipa at Red Spruce. The same thing. It was respect the animal, respect the seafood, respect the sustainability of that fishing environment so that not only our kids, but our kids' kids enjoy the same things that we do.
So both of the states have been hit hard with a number of things from COVID. The fishermen themselves, because people aren't going to restaurants as much, so there's not as much demand for fish. All kinds of ripple effects from COVID. What's the situation in New Orleans right now?
We're beaten up by the same exact things. We can't get restaurant staff to come in because, number one, they're worried about infections. Mm-hmm. They're worried about that close contact. They're also worried about vaccinations. So as we move forward, that things start to open up. But as we look deeper into it with the fishermen, with the seafood producers, as COVID hit, the demand died. The producers and the fishermen had to lay people off. So their employees have found different jobs. And now they're not available to come back and harvest what we have in the oceans, the bounty of the sea. So we're fighting that from both sides. We don't have the infrastructure inside the restaurant to be able to produce. And we don't have the substructure from the fishermen to provide. But now demand from tourism is starting to blossom. And I'm sure you see that in Alaska as well. The cruise ships are going to start coming back, and the restaurants don't have the people to be able to feed them. And so that's the biggest battle that we fight, is being able to uphold the standards that both states, Alaska and Louisiana, look at when we look at tourism. Tourism is our number one business in Louisiana. That's the hardest part, is making sure that when you come back after COVID, you receive the same or better experience that you did before COVID.
How about seafood sales? There were shortfalls in the restaurant industry because people weren't going to the restaurant, but people were cooking at home and experimenting. And so some of the retail salmon sales was a market that increased. Did you see that in Louisiana?
We saw some crazy things happen during the shutdown for COVID. So our seafood sales and in our local grocery stores, like our mom and pop local grocery stores, not the big names, they expanded their seafood sections. So we had certain fishermen, you know, harvesting softshell crabs or crawfish, and they couldn't sell them to their regular wholesaler that sends it to a restaurant. So they would call us and we would connect them with local smaller grocery stores in their area. And so we saw seafood sections expanding and growing. They were taking out meat and putting in more seafood. That was new relationships that were developed in our industry. So we got a statistic back the other day. It was seafood sales just in retail grocery during COVID grew about 48%. So just seafood sales only. Pretty cool to say that something grew that quickly within the course of a few months.
So that's maybe one of the silver linings.
Yeah, new relationships and people found new places to source their seafood. And at the same time, we always knew they're itching to go back to their restaurants. So that was another thing, is just encouraging people to go back to their restaurants. And a big push for us in Louisiana was to, whether you're dining out or you're picking up to go, whatever you're doing, just make sure it was Louisiana seafood.
So how much Alaska seafood is sold in Louisiana restaurants?
We don't have a figure because it's hard to track once it goes through their channels. But just in restaurants that we patronize, that I personally do, they have Alaskan salmon. I could say they definitely have a presence in a lot of Louisiana restaurants.
But to add on to that is not just the salmon side of it, but halibut, cod, all the other fish that you catch here, the king crab has really started to filter down to us so that we're seeing more and more Alaskan seafood. But fortunately for us, with the lieutenant governor and with Sam and what they do, we're pushing United States seafood and making sure that what we buy, what we use, is domestic. So in Louisiana, we have a mandate that if you have imported crawfish or shrimp, you have to put that on your menu so that diners know that this is domestic product. And I think that that's really where the two states sort of come together, because we're pushing domestic product, whether it be Louisiana white shrimp or whether it be Alaskan halibut. It doesn't matter. It's about the fact that we are supporting each other in this time, mm-hmm. as opposed to looking for the best price, because oftentimes the best price is not the best value. It doesn't support our next door neighbor. And that's what we're really trying to push.
So when you've taken a close-up look at Alaska salmon closer to the source, what ideas occur to you for cooking it?
That's a great question. One of my favorite things that nobody does, I've never seen, is barbecued salmon. So I really take that Kansas City barbecue style, take a side of salmon, brush it with that, and then to blend it with the Louisiana flavors, I make a corn mock shoe.
Mm-hmm. Now, what is that?
So mock shoe, it means faux shoes, mock shoes, really where it came from. But it's corn, it's tomato, it's onion, and it's cooked down almost like a succotash, mm-hmm. but there's no beans in it, which succotash requires. And we'll put some okra in it, we'll cook it down, and it becomes this wonderful vegetable base for dishes that we do. So we do a catfish with mock shoe, anything. But the barbecued salmon, the barbecue sauce sort of sets off that fatty flavor in the salmon. And then we put it with the traditional Louisiana mock shoe, and you get this clean vegetable flavor that we get from all our local vendors. And you end up with blending the two. On top of that, the halibut, that's another thing that's really big down south. We'll take halibut. It's such a sturdy fish. We can butter poach it. We can grill it. Yesterday, we blackened halibut in Creole style, mm-hmm. and served it as a bouillabaisse, and it turned out fantastic. So it's really about just taking different proteins and looking at it going, how do I take Louisiana shrimp and cook them where Alaskans are like it?
Yeah,
and
exactly.
How do I take rock shrimp from up here and cook it where somebody from Louisiana goes, that's the best damn shrimp I ever had?
Well, I could see halibut in bouillabaisse.
Yes.
Mm. Yum. You're making me hungry.
It was good.
That's why we're here.
So what aha moments did you have here?
Here? Oh, so many aha moments. Gosh. Just being out on the water today was something special for me. Seeing all the boats, you know, with all their traps and baskets that they have on there. And then just going out on the water, just kind of at the end of the day being like, all these people just go home and do the same things that we do. We support fishermen. We're fishermen. So it's just kind of one of those things, like no matter what part of the country you're in, passion knows no state lines. So that's what's kind of cool.
How about you, Mike?
So last night we had the dinner at the brewery and at Red Spruce with Nell Udipa. And as I looked out over the harbor and saw the mountains and the majesty and the beauty of what you guys have up here, that's where I looked at and said, you know what? I could cook here for a while.
That was aha. Nell, I'm moving in.
It was so majestic to see what the coastline. And then today to go out on a boat and tour around the different fjords and the bays around Juneau and see the islands and the majestic mountains and then the whales and the sea lions and the sea life that you guys have. So we left that boat, we came on shore, and we were told, hey, guess what, guys? You get to make crawfish and alligator tacos tonight for an event.
Seriously?
Yeah, and we had about...
Did you bring alligator?
Yes, we have alligator. And so we had about 5 minutes to figure out how we were going to make this happen. And Sam's husband, Cody, was with me, and then Nell Udipa from here. We sort of put our heads together. We put this menu together. We run to Fred Meyer, I guess it is, and pick up some stuff and come back. And within an hour, we're feeding people. That was another aha. A deeper moment for me was to look at the fact that you can take three brains that don't share a single cell together and throw them in a room, and then all of a sudden we come out with a menu. And people at the event were just raving over what we had done. And I have to give all the credit to Cody and to Nell because we got this. Don't worry.
So what restaurant was this?
Deckhand Dave's.
Deckhand Dave's Taco Bar. We did tacos this evening.
With alligator?
Alligator mm-hmm. and crawfish.
The one question I have about crawfish is... They're so little itty bitty. It seems like there's so much work in getting any meat out of those. What is the fascination with crawfish, the draw?
Well, they're not itty bitty. I saw a picture yesterday. Somebody had a crawfish that was the size of a dollar bill. So that's pretty big. I mean, that's the size of your hand. They're super quick to peel. So, you know, a lot of people think it's work, but I mean, when you're sitting at a table sticking your fork in your plate, you might as well just be popping a tail and putting it in your mouth. So crawfish are really special in Louisiana, and it's one of the biggest commodities that we have in Louisiana. We have over 1,600 crawfish farmers. So they're raised in little ponds with tiny little levees and rice fields that they flood. This year, they recorded almost 250,000 acres of crawfish ponds that were fished.
So for one person, a one-person serving, how many crawdads do you need?
It depends. So my average... My average is 5. Like, I can put down 5 to 8 pounds of crawfish in one sitting. A normal person, I'm not calling myself not normal, but a normal person who doesn't eat crawfish every other day like I do, they'll probably take in about 3 pounds. Because you also have the accompaniment. So you have your boiled potatoes and your sausage, your corn, your mushrooms, your onions, your garlic. Sometimes you throw in an artichoke or two. So
green beans.
Yeah.
Anything you boil, we throw into that crawfish bowl. Sweet potatoes is another thing. Pineapples. Anything you can boil, we throw into a crawfish boil. And when it all comes out, You started with 30 pounds of crawfish and you fed 60 people. It's not the crawfish. It's everything else that goes into
it. And the crawfish probably seasons everything else, right?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
Gives it the flavor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was fun. We had, 20 pounds of crawfish today? Mm-hmm. 20 pounds of crawfish, and we made somewhere on the average of about 160 tacos with 20 pounds of crawfish. And so they go a long way. They have this super rich flavor. And the nice thing about crawfish, Sam and I can both eat about 5 pounds, but they're rich, they're buttery, and you sort of get filled up. And it's not about the crawfish. It's about the camaraderie. It's about that feeling of place, of getting people together. And we're all standing around, and we're peeling crawfish together. We're having cold beers. We're eating sausage and telling stories about... We went to Alaska and we cooked with our good friends. And so it's a communal effort. It's not just, I'm going to cook 2 pounds of crawfish for myself tonight.
No,
that's not crawfish.
You commit. It's 30 pounds at a time.
So tell me about the alligator tacos. Have you done that before?
About 3 o'clock this afternoon, I was told we're doing alligator tacos. So yes, to answer your question, it's the first time I've ever made alligator tacos in my life.
What kind of seasoning did you use? Did you use typical Mexican seasonings for those tacos?
No, we went straight Louisiana. I found Paul Prudhomme's Black and Redfish Magic, and I got some pineapple juice because the enzymes will break down the fibers and make it a little more tender. And then we found this Jack Daniel's chicken seasoning that looked really interesting, so we threw that in there. And then we found some Nashville hot chicken seasoning, so we threw that in there. And we mixed all this together, and we threw the alligator meat in, and then we threw it on a 700-degree grill for about 10 minutes. Pulled it off, and it was just spoon tender. Not fork tender, spoon tender.
Mm.
And Deckhand Dave's had this great slaw and pico. We mixed that together. We put it on. And it was a marriage made in heaven. It was Alaska and Louisiana combined. Mm-hmm.
So I have to ask this because I've never tried alligator. What kind of meat is it most like in flavor?
Everybody has their own opinion of what alligator is like. For me, when it's cooked correctly, it is a great pork chop, be it a thin cut or a thick cut, however you cook it. The texture and the flavor reminds me of a great pork chop. A little more gamey, but not so much that it's off-putting. But the texture, people say everything tastes like chicken. To me, this one is a pork.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not about so much the dish as more the feeling. And that's really what I'm all about. When you boil it down, the state of Louisiana is all about, it's feed your soul. It's all about the feeling that you get. It's not the food. The food is the cherry on the sundae, but that emotion that you get by being there, by experiencing what's going on.
I hesitate to try to pronounce it, but what is the phrase, the French phrase?
Phrase?
Yes.
Laissez les bon temps rouler.
Let the good times roll.
Yeah.
Gumbo line, a crawfish pie, and a filet gumbo. Cause tonight I'm gonna see Mama Shazamio.
And that was Samantha Carroll with the Louisiana Seafood Promotion and Marketing Board and Chef Mike Brewer, owner of the NOLA Ghost Kitchen in the New Orleans area. And he was also crowned King of Louisiana Seafood in 2015.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
You're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. Thanks for being here with us on this Friday when we send you off to the weekend with the Juno Audubon Society's Summer Friday Bird Watch, in which we focus on three birds and Brenda Wright is always on the lookout for us, and we always start off talking about what was Brenda's last bird-watching trip and what she was hoping to see. So, Brenda, are you ready to give us an update?
Oh, you bet. This has been a very exciting week at Moose Lake. In the Dredge Lake areas, it's nice and flat. It's easy to walk around, and there's a lot of birds that we don't often see in Juneau, but they all live around Moose Lake, so I highly recommend going there.
So what were you hoping to see?
I was hoping to see the American Redstart and possibly a water thrush. And I wasn't successful, but other people were.
So where are we in the season? I mean, we're getting close to the solstice here. Does the bird watching kind of wane with the solstice passing?
You know, fortunately for us, just as the last of the birds start arriving here in Juneau, then we get to see the babies. And so that's one of the most fun parts. Check to see where you might see some mallard babies or watch a robin nest or see the juncos so busy on the trail they can't possibly skip out of your way because they're getting the food for the babies.
Well, you've picked three birds for us this week. So let's start with the Canada goose. And I think we all know what Canada geese are. We've seen them quite a bit. But why did you pick that bird for this week?
Well, you know, I was thinking that we needed to go from the biggest bird that we get to see here, as far as weight goes, and the smallest. So we're going to go from the Canada goose to the Rufous hummingbird, with a little bit in between.
And we get to hear what they sound like. So let's listen to the Canada goose in case you've forgotten what they sound like when they go honking across the sky.
And I'm so glad you mentioned that because it's so nice to have birds, even if they're far in the distance, let you know where they are and where to look.
So the sound is a big clue. So what do you think is so nice about looking for the Canada goose in the summertime?
The ones that often stay here through the winter don't actually nest around us here. So the ones we're seeing often in the spring and early summer are the ones that are just passing through to go to another place. Because of that and because of the migration back, they're one of the most common birds we can see all year round.
So what do they do while they're here?
You know, in the wintertime, they have this wonderful opportunity because of the high tides that we have here to have a smorgasbord that's open after every high tide. And that leaves them a lot of feasts for the wintertime so they don't have to travel far south to feed well.
So where are their favorite places?
Oh, the Mendenhall wetlands are definitely their favorite places.
So our next bird is the Swainson's thrush. You said you're going from biggest to smallest, so this is in the middle, I guess.
Well, it's quite a bit tinier than a Canada goose, but it's quite a bit huger than a hummingbird.
And I should mention that we have some pictures posted on our website of these, and this is a photo of a Swainson's thrush that Bob Armstrong took, and the bird has a bug in its mouth.
It's always great to get to see them working at their successful nests.
So tell us a little about the Swainson's thrush.
You know, it's the very last thrush to come, and it's first cousin to the robin and the buried thrush. So it's about that size, but it's very, very secretive, but it has a beautiful, beautiful song. I'm sure you'll appreciate it once you get to hear it.
All right, let's take a listen. It is a much more musical call than some of the others that we've heard.
Yes, indeed it is. And it's nice that it likes to do it as it starts to get twilight. So it's kind of late at night or early in the morning when you get to hear this one.
So this is a small bird. How hard is it to spot them?
If they don't want you to see them, you won't see them. But you will get to hear them. So that it is a difficult one. It's the last thrush to arrive here, so the leaves are large, and it's only robin-sized, and it doesn't feed on the ground right in front of you. So It's a toughie, but you can hear it.
So our last bird is the Rufous Hummingbird. And we have a lovely picture on our website of Jessica Millsaps. And it is just this lovely golden bird. And it looks like it has almost this medieval type of collar around it. Like it has almost like a plate of armor around it.
Yeah, the hummingbirds use this that beautiful fluorescent throat marking to flare out at all other males. And amazingly, these small birds are very territorial, and you can hear it when you hear the sound.
I just wouldn't have expected that the hummingbird would have much of a sound because they're just so tiny. And they're just flitting around, and it looks like it's taking all of their energy to keep them aloft, and that they wouldn't have, you know, much capacity to make a sound.
Yep, but at the same time, these tiny birds are territorial, and they want to make sure that everybody knows that that feeder or that female is already taken possession.
How interesting that the tiniest of the birds is one of the most fierce.
Yes.
Where are you suggesting people go these days? What would be good this weekend?
Well, you know, for sure, this is the time of year when you're going to hear the bird songs in the alders and the willows. There's some really interesting birds along the Brotherhood Bridge Trail, but if the Moose Lake area, the Dredge Lake area, the Glacier Moraine Trail, those are the kind of places where you're going to hear the most songs and possibly see the most birds.
All right. Well, we want to thank you very much, Brenda. Brenda Wright with the Juneau Audubon Society, giving us our three birds of the week and always much more. Thanks, Brenda.
Thank you, Rhonda.
And that'll do it for Juneau Afternoon today. I'm Rhonda McBride, your host today. I want to thank all of you for joining us. And whether you're watching birds or pursuing other forms of happiness, hope you have a great weekend.